Dr. Wills was appointed to the faculty of Southern Seminary in 1997. After serving since 1994 as Archives and Special Collections Librarian with the seminary's Boyce Centennial Library, Dr. Wills' dissertation, Democratic Religion, Freedom, Authority, and Church Discipline in the Baptist South, 1785 through 1900, was published by Oxford University Press. Besides contributions to theological journals, Dr. Wills has authored entries on Basil Manley Jr., Jesse Mercer in the American National Biography, and his most recent work, as you see displayed in front of him, is A History of Southern Seminary, which we're really excited about. Dr. Nettles is widely regarded as one of the foremost Baptist historians in America. He came to Southern Seminary from the faculty of Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, where he was professor of church history and chair of the Department of Church History. He previously taught at Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary and Mid-America Baptist Theological Seminary. Along with numerous journal articles and scholarly papers, Dr. Nettles is the author or editor of 9 books. Among his books are By His Grace and For His Glory, one of my favorites, Baptists in the Bible, the highly influential volume which he co-authored with L. Russ Bush, and Why I Am a Baptist, co-edited with Russell D. Moore, and, of course, his most recent book on the founder of Southern Seminary, James P. Boyce. At this point, I'd like to turn it over to our authors and speakers and let them give an overview of their book. Gentlemen, feel free to dialogue with each other and ask each other questions regarding your works. And if you have questions, please text them. If we don't have a really tech-savvy audience this morning, if you don't feel like texting, I may just open it up for you to raise your hand and ask a question the old-fashioned way. So this time, Dr. Wills, I'll turn it over to you first.
Dr. Nettles, I'd like to ask you to begin, if that's all right with you.
Oh, is that... that was a dirty trick. Well, I think one of the things that is worthy of remark about these two books is how much ground is overlapping. When Dr. Wills was working on the first part of the book, of course, he had to deal a lot with James Pettigrew Boyce and with that first faculty. And, of course, that's what I was working on entirely, was the life of Boyce and his the sources, the letters, the editorial work. And so I think a part of the enjoyment that we both had was being able to talk with each other about this. And yes, he would tell me letters that he found and archival treasures, and we would pose questions to each other about what we thought about certain issues, and if we were working on common sources sometimes, how we evaluated this. And so for me, it was a very enriching experience to be able to talk with a colleague that has had such a depth of knowledge of the sources, and to be able to, in a couple of occasions, frankly, keep myself from some embarrassing sentences that I put in that were not exactly accurate. I don't say this in any kind of insincere sucking up, but really, Dr. Wills is one of the most thorough researchers I have ever known. He has a technique and a knowledge about finding the sources, getting to the sources, synthesizing the sources, and then developing a very readable way of communicating from a massive number of sources that he's collected. And so it was a real pleasure to work alongside him in this.
Can I just say that it is a rare privilege to have a colleague who is working on things in the same area so that you can have these kinds of discussions. And Dr. Nettles also spared me from a couple of embarrassing errors.
So shall we sing, "We belong to a mutual admiration society"?
You'll have to do that on your own, okay, brother.
I think that right now, just from the standpoint of the kinds of books that have been coming out recently, this generation has an opportunity to learn more about the early days of Southern Baptist life than perhaps any generation in a long time. Another book that is out is a book by a man named James Slatton about W.H. Whitsitt. And the Whitsitt era was one of the most provocative eras in the history of Southern Seminary and of Southern Baptist life. And Dr. Slatton had access to about 16 volumes of private diaries. I know Dr. Wills was able to gain access to some of that, and he has some knowledge of that, and his conclusions that he drew about Dr. Whitsitt were just right on target in light of the larger picture that Dr. Slatin is able to present. So there's that book that can just, that really gives a very clear presentation of the personality and the inner life of one of the most controversial figures in Southern Baptist life. And also, as Dr. Wills points out, it brought about a mentality change in the relationship between higher education and the local churches that was then nursed throughout the 20th century. So that's a very important book. And then Dr. Wills's book on the history of the seminary, I mean, this is an ironic thing, but it's a page-turner and a nail-biter. It's just like you can't wait to see what's going to happen next, because it is filled with all the drama and the tension that really does develop in when you have theological conflict and you have these personalities operating with each other. I really appreciate what he's done so much, and reading through that book can give you a massive understanding of much of the dynamic of Southern Baptist life. And then the biography of James P. Boyce can give you a broad perspective of one particular era in Southern Baptist life that Dr. Wills calls the heroic age. Then there's some source books out also. Michael Haken and some others have put out a source book on Basil Manley Jr. and Basil Manley Sr. that has a lot of the primary sources of that. And so if you can get that book, that will help you. So you have a great opportunity right now to just learn a lot of things about Southern Baptist life and to have something of a mature, an ability to reflect maturely on the kind of theological development and the theological dynamic that has been at work that explains a lot about where we are today.
So why is it important for us to understand this founding era?
The founding era, I think, was at one level, I think that it was an era in which they had a deep sense that the agencies and the institutions were to reflect the will and to reflect the thinking of the church. And when Southern Seminary was established, that is why they did it. They wanted it to be a Baptist school. He was very jealous for its reflecting what the Baptists believed at that time. I think he even made a few personal sacrifices in the overall orientation of the school, just so it would be a clear reflection of what the churches wanted and to prepare ministers for the churches. That was very clearly the intent. I think somewhere along the way, there was began to be a misplaced emphasis on the prophetic role of some of the institutions. We need to go beyond where the churches are and lead them. In some ways, that may be good, don't you think? In some ways, it's good to have a prophetic role because we recognize there's always more learning. In another way, that can be kind of a condescending attitude, and to see how this early generation balanced this prophetic role with a sincere desire to reflect the true intention of the churches, I think is very instructive and can help us compare and give us a goal to move back to.
Right, and that is one of the things that struck me as I was doing research on this book. And with regard to the research, there's a backstory here that's of interest to historians and scholars. There's so much material out there, much of it only having become available in the last few years. For example, the Harold Tribble papers. He was the successor to E.Y. Mullins in the chair of theology. The Henley Barnett papers, who held the chair of ethics for so many years after World War II. And several other sets of papers like this. Massive collections of 50,000, 75,000 pages of correspondence that have only just become available, and they are very valuable to telling this whole story. So it was a great drudgery in many ways, but a great joy also to be able to go and find
one of the sources you used that I was not familiar with. There are several you used I was familiar with, but one that was very interesting was the Hugh Womble material. How many volumes of that material?
Hugh Womble was a professor of church history at Southern Seminary, who was one of 13 professors who was fired by Duke McCall and the Board of Trustees in 1958. And it's a complex story, but Hugh Womble saw himself as something of an attorney. I think he wanted to be an attorney if he wasn't going to be a preacher. And so he kept this record of all of these documents, gathered all the documents, recorded. After he had conversations or meetings, he would record the things that they had discussed, and so he had contemporary records of his impressions at the time. And then in the early 1990s, He wrote over 1,000 pages trying to chronicle this entire thing, drawing on all those sources. And it's an incredibly valuable resource in many ways. So it was fascinating. But there you get the insider's testimony from the side of the 13. And I had access here, of course, to Duke McCall's papers and to some of the others who is on the trustee records that told this other side from the administration side and the other half of the faculty who did not agree with the 13 who were fired.
One of the things that's difficult to do in writing a history, especially the kind that I think that Dr. Wells was writing, is to report things factually and at the same time create something of the tension and the dynamic that was present at the time so that you feel what was going on. You feel the way one group felt, you feel the way another group felt. And one of the sections where I think that Dr. Will shows his skill as a historian is where he is presenting the viewpoint that the leaders of that 13 had. He has maybe a page and a half or 2 pages in which he just does almost an apologetic for the way they felt about what they were doing, why they wanted to carry the seminary in a certain direction, why they wanted to be able to be idealistic in their presentation of the viewpoints that they had come to, why they thought it would be good for the churches. They didn't see themselves as destructive. They didn't see themselves as trying to destroy Christianity, destroy the churches. They saw themselves as preparing the churches for the future. And Dr. Wills does a great job of just outlining their thinking on that and then coming back with his understanding of sort of the historic Baptist understanding of that dynamic. It's one of those things that keeps you on edge and wondering how this is. Well, I mean, you know how it comes out, but nevertheless, he creates the tension and the dynamic that is there, and that is an art that a historian has to work hard at. And that's one of the things I appreciate so much about what Dr. Wells has done is he gives those sides of the story, and he lets you feel that tension that is developing.
You know, part of that dynamic and that tension that emerges in post-World War II era with the rise of liberalism and neo-orthodoxy in Southern Baptist life, especially in the seminaries, reflected very clearly in the ministry of some of those professors at Southern Seminary, is this dynamic between orthodox doctrine and religious experience. And, of course, that's one of the things that drove liberals going all the way back to Schleiermacher. Someone has texted in a question, please respond to this statement. Is it possible to separate doctrine and Jesus? Can you preach Jesus without doctrines? Now, in many ways, Boyce's vision for the seminary reflects the answer to that question, doesn't it?
Yeah. Boyce, of course, would not think that you can preach Jesus without doctrine because you define Jesus in terms of the way he is presented in divine revelation. You define him in terms of what the church has deduced from their study of Scripture, the way that they have formulated their understanding of Christ. He was very strongly orthodox in setting forth the real humanity of Christ. I think the genuine humanity of Christ was one of the most precious and mysterious doctrines to Boyce. He built much off of his understanding of the humanity of Christ, and then the singularity of his person, having the full divine nature of the eternal Son of God united with this assumed humanity, was a powerful doctrine of the Boyce. And he would not think that you are preaching Jesus unless you have a full-orbed understanding of this orthodox Christology. To say that you just want to preach Jesus and have an experience with Jesus and yet shove aside the biblical orthodoxy would be completely contradictory to him. I don't think he could conceive of any possibility of even doing that and maintaining a genuine Christian witness.
And in many ways, it was his fear of that kind of thing happening. He saw some evidence and around the edges of Baptist life and in some of the other denominations that this kind of thing could happen. And his vision was to establish a seminary that was committed to biblical orthodoxy, that the churches might grow strong and sound. And one of the things that came out in my reflection on the history of the seminary was just how important Boyce's founding vision was, not only for Southern Seminary, but for Southern Baptists. Boyce and his colleagues established a standard and planted it on a hill in Southern Baptist life. This is what we understand the Bible to mean. This is what the Holy Spirit has inspired. This is what our churches will defend and proclaim, and this is what will move them and encourage them to take the gospel to the ends of the earth. And that flag stood on that hill throughout much turmoil in the 19th and 20th century, and that flag stands still. It's amazing. You look at the letters that came in to the presidents of this seminary over the decades, and over again, they would refer back to Boyce. Right into the 70s and 80s, they would say, remember Boyce. Remember Boyce and Broadus and Toy. And so this seminary's founding generation is incredibly important to this day.
I think one thing that that everyone would agree on, even in the past controversy, is that whatever happened at Southern Seminary in the last 20 years could not have happened had there not been a confessional standard. It was the confessional standard which appeal was made. It was a confessional standard that had some way to be manipulated in order for some of the things that happened that had happened. And so however a person comes out in the end on whether or not they agree or disagree with what did happen, I think all would agree that without the confessional standard, without the abstract of principles, nothing would have happened. It was just very important for that to be there.
Well, let's take some questions, if there are any, from those gathered here.
Let me make a statement about Boyce that maybe prompts something. One person asked me, were there any surprises that you had when you were doing your study of Boyce? And in one sense, there weren't, because I had read Boyce and loved Boyce for a long time. But in another sense, there were two surprises that I can think of right now. One is, I didn't really realize how utterly devoted he was to systematic theology. How he loved systematic theology, and he saw it as a genuine expression of Christian discipleship. He saw it as absolutely essential for a minister of the gospel. And as he goes around talking to these different associations, one of the things he'll always bring in here in the curriculum of the school, this is what we teach, and we have this, that we have systematic theology, polemic theology, and every preacher needs to know this, and if you don't know this, you know you're going to make bad mistakes, and in 1 year study of systematic theology, you can learn what has taken the church 1,500 years to learn. He focuses on that. He loves systematic theology, and probably the greatest sacrifice that he made for the seminary was his taking himself away from the teaching of systematic theology for 5 years, turning it over to someone else while he was trying to raise an endowment. And so his genuine love for systematic theology as an expression of Christian commitment was one of the things that became much more prominent in my understanding of Boyce. The second thing is the genuine piety that Boyce had. It was not something that was just to make him appear more cerebral than those around him. Systematic theology was a path to the knowledge of God and a path to the mortification of self. It was something in which he genuinely was saw as an avenue for discipleship, for being conformed to Christ. He wanted to subdue or to see systematic theology as a means by which to be conformed to Christ. It was a genuine piety that he had in the use of that. So those are sort of two things that I learned that were not completely surprising, but the degree to which he held them was a happy experience.
Are there questions?
Could we get, if I could ask you to step up to the microphone and ask your question through the mic so everyone could hear it.
I thoroughly enjoyed Dr. Nettle's book on Baptist catechisms. And I just wonder, have you given much thought, or do you know of anyone else who has given much thought into how to actually get that kind of thing back into our churches, how to get that kind of a children's almost systematic theology back into church life, Baptist church life?
Well, I think it should be done. And the only way it will be done, I think, is when it is seen as an ongoing part of the education program of a church. When it starts early and a church can develop it, can develop a, some sort of catechetical approach for children and have goals related to that. By the time they're through the fifth grade, we want them to understand something about these doctrines and continue that in like sixth through the eighth grade and have another catechetical approach. I think it's a very helpful, not to replace Bible study, not to replace other things, but something that is sort of an understood part of the education in the local church, so that by the time, if a child were to start in the children's divisions and go all the way through high school, he would come out with an ability to express himself and express his doctrine in language that has been developed in the history of the church, and then he would be able to think for himself. And by the time he's in high school, he studies Christian doctrine, and so he understands the reason for this vocabulary. He's able to formulate his own understanding, he's able to articulate it, he's able to put it in many different ways. I think that the best apologetic for Christianity is a thorough understanding of what it is. So many of the objections that come, and the reason we're bumfuzzled many times about defending Christianity, is we really don't understand the beauty and the coherence of Scripture and of the doctrine within it. There are many times that objections to Christian faith can be answered simply by giving a clear statement of what the doctrine actually is. And I believe the better we train the people for whom we're responsible in that, then the stronger their witness will be, and the more profound. I mean, this doesn't automatically save them or anything, but it gives a foundation for the operations of the Spirit of God in their heart when they are converted. The more profound their witness will be. I mean, the Apostle Paul already had so many things in mind, such a great knowledge of Scripture. When he was converted and he began to say, oh, this is about Jesus of Nazareth, why, his understanding then was just mammoth. And I believe that is part of the effect that a catechetical approach would have in our young people. So the implication of your question certainly was that we should do this, and I think it's a matter of just becoming determined and having leadership in a church see it as important.
Are there other questions?
Dr. Wilson, I've not had the opportunity to read your book, but I want to ask a question regarding the finished product of liberalism. As the seminary fell away from the abstract of principles and students were not being taught systematic theology as I have learned it at Southern Seminary, what was the finished product as one walked across the line of graduation and could say, I'm a graduate of Southern Seminary? What did they learn?
Yes, Troy. Well, their different faculty members had somewhat different visions of the end product. There were some faculty members who wanted to produce scholars, and the scholars had to be not only well instructed but also convinced of the presuppositions of historical criticism, the methods of historical criticism, and the conclusions of historical criticism in the broader academy. So they had to be introduced into that. Others saw this modern approach to religious scholarship as being relevant, the most relevant approach to founding useful churches. Now, the reason they thought this was because they did not believe that the traditional orthodoxy could withstand the criticisms of modern science in areas like evolution. And so they thought the old approach would lead to an irrelevant church, an irrelevant gospel. And so they wanted to train people in the modern approach to religion so they could have a relevant approach. I think others emphasized the practical. Others emphasize, well, the theology that we teach here may not be the traditional orthodoxy, but it is a theology that we can use still to train preachers and to train evangelists. Now, in all three cases, you don't have the traditional approach of the first generation. You do have something very different. Now, what was the finished product? And many times they were successful in producing those three kinds of students. In other cases, in many cases, you had conservatives that came to this school who basically kept their fingers in their ears for 3 years and then got out with the same faith they had, but not well instructed. They missed an opportunity. And then there were a significant number who came with the faith of their church and left without any faith. And that's a story that has not been told. I mean, many of us know anecdotes here and there, but this is a tragedy that I hope someday someone will be able to research and fill out. Other questions? I wanted to say something about just how amazing the revolution is that has occurred here at Southern Seminary in the last 16 years. It's most people know that there's been an amazing transformation, an amazing revolution. I think people don't know just how difficult that was. The Board of Trustees, as the Southern Baptist Convention elected conservative trustees beginning in the early 1980s, and as then those conservative trustees gained a majority in 1990, and as they elected Al Mulder president in 1993, I think it's hard to appreciate just how much difficulty, how much struggle, how much grief they faced in this process. And that's part of the story I try to bring out in the book, to try to experience that, see that, understand that. This was not an easy thing. It wasn't just a battle for the messengers and for the votes on the floor of the Southern Baptist Convention. Every single entity in the SBC struggled to be transformed, to transform itself into one that would be better pleasing and more faithful.
You have mentioned a couple of times the word liberalism, and I think everybody has some general idea of what we're talking about when we say that, but you have studied the whole development of liberalism and modernism, and you've seen it in the light of the way it was expressed in Southern Baptist life. Could you give us just a thumbnail sketch of what you're saying when you use the word liberalism? Is it something that relates to a full-blown theology, or is it a methodology that you're talking about, or is it a view of Scripture, or some combination of those? What do you have in mind when you use that word as it relates to Southern Baptists?
Right. Of course, liberalism has been historically a variegated thing, but liberalism tends to be on a trajectory. Liberalism begins with a liberal view of the inspiration of the Scriptures, and it is driven by an apologetic. And this is something that's widely misapprehended today. Liberals did not seek, and as you said earlier, to destroy the faith or to destroy the church. Liberals sought to save the church. They believed and believe today that their approach to the Scriptures will save the faith, and they will save the faith of our young people who go off to college and make a stronger, and they believe, therefore, more biblical faith. But it begins with a liberal view of inspiration, which says that the Bible is inspired. Liberals believe that the Bible is inspired. You meet someone who says that, I don't believe the Bible is inspired, they're not a liberal. They're a radical, they're a materialist, they're something else. They're not a liberal. A liberal believes in the inspiration of the Bible, but the liberal does not believe in the full inspiration of the Bible. The liberal view of inspiration is that only the religious or spiritual truths of the Bible are inspired, not its statements on, not its statements on history, on geography, on geology, or any other statement, just the spiritual. And beginning there, that premise, that principle leads to a hermeneutic that is destructive of the traditional conclusions of the Christian faith. Now, not every liberal will draw those conclusions out. Many of them, in their hearts, know better, and they refuse to draw out those conclusions. But some of their colleagues will draw them out, and certainly many of their students will draw them out. So you have someone like E.Y. Mullins, who was president of Southern Seminary from 1899 to 1928, who embraced this liberal view of inspiration, but did not follow that hermeneutic out to the conclusions that a liberal colleague of his, like Shaler Matthews at the University of Chicago Divinity School, did. Shaler Matthews ends up a theistic, some kind of theistic faith that's far removed from historic orthodoxy.
God is defined as the personality-producing power of the cosmos.
Right. You see, something very far removed from traditional Christianity, whereas Mullins refuses to follow his hermeneutical principles out to those conclusions in most cases. In a few cases, he does alter orthodoxy, but mostly he retains traditional conclusions. And so do you call someone like E.Y. Mullins a liberal? And this is a very difficult question. I think ultimately I don't know the answer. I tend to say, yes, he was a liberal because of that presupposition. But I recognize that he remained faithful at many, many points of doctrine.
Gentlemen, we have time for one more question before we'll conclude our Q&A. And I would invite you to move to the other side of the booth for a book signing. We do have one giveaway. So if you don't have a book with you, you may be the lucky person. We'll give you a book that you could have signed. If you would ask the last question, sir.
I was looking at a doctorate program when all this stuff was going on, and I think it was on the second half when there was a lot of ill feeling, but most of the things had happened, And when I visited some of the doctorate classes, I was kind of surprised. The majority of the students were way to the left of the professors at that point. And at the time, I just thought that was strange. But as I look back and reflect on it now, I wonder, what was it about the school at that time that obviously was attracting that kind of students? I just wonder, what was it about the school that was attracting students that, you know, if they were studying Moltmann's universalism and everybody in the class almost says we're all universalists. What was it that was attracting that kind of student? Because that's not what the professors were teaching, per se. I mean, the professors say, well, I don't agree with Moltmann on this, but the students were like, they were all way to the left of the professors when I was there, and I didn't quite really understand how was the school attracting these kind of students.
Well, the character of the faculty did not change overnight, and so we had, it took about 5 years to change over the majority of the faculty from those inclined to these kinds of liberalism that we're talking about to those who maintain historic orthodoxy. And so during that period, 5, 6, 7 years, there still were some professors there who held these views. And, of course, students, especially in the PhD program, take many years to finish. And so many of these students may have been admitted in 1991, 92, or 93, but still been finishing the coursework a number of years later.
But also, I think there's a dynamic, and you may have been talking about some professors that actually were liberal in one sense, but their students were far left of them. I think that it has to do, that dynamic is difficult, but I think it has to do with anchor points that people have. A professor who's been there for a while, he has an anchor point in the denomination, in the expectation of the churches. He learns how far he can go and still provide something that is recognizable in the churches as a person who has a Baptist, Southern Baptist training. A student, though, who has picked up on the basic principle that we're to be scholars and we're to know what the latest scholarship is, and we are not fettered by this ancient orthodoxy or by any mechanical view of inspiration or something, they become much more intellectually free and don't feel the same sort of anchor points that the professor may. And so their anchor point is something that's way further out here, and so they're moving further left, but it's based upon the principles they have learned, but they don't have the same maybe sociological connections, or maybe they don't have the same intellectual background the professor has that keeps him tethered there. And so he has picked up another way of thinking, and he is just much more consistent in his application of the intellectual commitment that he has.